rights, then what is so wrong with our American juvenile justice system? That is the question asked by my next guest. Her name is Kara Drynan. She is a juvenile justice expert and a professor at Catholic University Law School and the author of a new book called The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. Kara, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. Let's just start with the very simplest question. What is wrong with how our justice system handles cases involving juveniles?
Right. So the United States invented the juvenile court model at the end of the 19th century, and within about 100 years, we had become an international outlier in the way we sentence children. So today, for example, we are the only nation that sentences children to die in prison. Youth can be housed in adult correctional facilities. Youth are subject to conditions of confinement that we think of as really only appropriate for the most dangerous of adult inmates. And until 2005, we were the only nation to execute people for juvenile crimes. So our sentencing practices are incredibly punitive, and they are having a disproportionate impact on poor minority kids in particular.
But it sounds like, from what you said there, that things were different in previous generations. When were they better?
Yeah, they were better until probably the middle of the 20th century. And as many of your listeners, I'm sure, know, in the latter part of the 20th century, there was really a movement across the political spectrum to be tough on crime. And unfortunately, kids were swept up in that system. Part of that tough on crime movement in the 1970s involved introducing transfer laws, laws that made it easier to charge children as if they were adults, and also the introduction of mandatory sentencing schemes. And so you had those two trends, and together they were really the perfect storm for kids. Kids ended up being charged as adults in adult court, and if convicted in adult court, they were subject to mandatory minimums drafted with adults in mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty recent phenomenon.
Was there one case in particular that made you want to write this book? I know as an expert in this, you've looked at hundreds, if not thousands, of juvenile justice cases. But was there one that's made you say, okay, I got to write about this?
Absolutely. Yes. And that gentleman who's at the heart of the book is Terrence Graham. And in 2003, when he was 16, Terrence and three friends attempted to rob a barbecue restaurant in Florida. And despite the fact that no one was seriously injured in this unsuccessful attempted armed robbery, Terrence ultimately received a life without parole sentence for his involvement in that non-homicide crime. And while the Supreme Court, fortunately, years later, found that sentence to be unconstitutional, it was Terrence's case and even his resentence of 25 years that really, for me, made me think, gosh, if I'm a law professor and I'm unaware of the severity of juvenile sentencing practices in America, I bet most of America is, too.
All right. Explain to me the rationale used by any prosecutor or any judge to, in the first place, say no one was hurt. This kid went in there with a couple of other friends, and they tried to rob a place, but nobody ended up getting hurt. We're going to lock him up forever.
Right. So, you know, the background is always a little more complicated than it appears, right? And so I think the rationale of a prosecutor is that attempted armed robbery is a serious crime, which, of course, it is. Florida is one of the most punitive states in the nation in terms of sentences on the books for crimes like that. And so I think the argument in that case was that Terrence had been given a suspended sentence initially and was put on probation, and he was allegedly involved in another crime. The state never proved that or even went to trial on that because he had violated some terms of his probation. So that sentence was hanging over him. But I think your larger question is, what's the rationale for that? And again, it's really that notion of adult crime, adult time that that was invented in the 80s and that today brain science tells us is just wrong.
At what age do you think a teenager should be treated legally as an adult?
Well, if I were drafting the laws, I would say that no child is eligible for an adult sentence until they reach the age of majority, which is 18. The science would actually suggest that youth, the frontal lobe of their brains are developing well into their 20s. And actually, some jurisdictions are moving toward sentencing protocols that consider youthful offenders to be up to the age of 23, for example, just to recognize that that frontal lobe is, as I said, still developing. And that's the part of our brain that controls things like judgment and long-term planning. So ideally, we would take that into account until someone's in their early 20s.
Yeah. In my mind, we have kind of two different categories. Well, actually, there are multiple categories, but I want to focus on two of them here. And one is a case like the one you just described where no one got hurt. Yeah, armed robbery is terrible, but nobody got hurt. And then there are other cases where somebody did get hurt. And in some cases in your book, you write about some kids who were there but didn't do the actual murder, but then got charged with felony murder, which is when someone dies while you're committing any kind of felony, you can be charged with felony murder. Why doesn't the justice system see these things differently when it comes to kids?
Right. I mean, again, I think it goes back to that notion that, you know, in the late 20th century, we were seeing rising crime rates and people were concerned about that. And so lawmakers across the country implemented these tough on crime laws. Felony murder is a great example of a one-size-fits-all kind of provision, and kids suffered at the hands of that. One thing that I think is worth pointing out, you know, I do profile some individuals who were charged and even convicted of homicide offenses, but I just want to point out that by far the majority of kids in the system are not there for serious offenses like homicide offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And juvenile incarceration, in fact, you know, we're not reserving it for serious offenses. In fact, in juvenile halls, only about 25% of inmates have been charged or convicted of serious offenses, including homicide. And so it's just a tremendous waste of human potential and taxpayer dollars.
How much of this is part of the war on drugs?
Huge part of it, right? I mean, the war on drugs ushered in mandatory sentencing schemes related to drug offenses and really created this cookie-cutter notion of, you know, we can determine at the outset what kind of sentence is appropriate for an individual based on the offense rather than the offender.
Mm-hmm. I should have said the failed war on drugs, which is how I always refer to it, because this is a classic example of what we're talking about.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if you step back from the picture of kids and look at the fact that the United States leads the world in its rate of incarceration, we have more than 2 million adults and children behind bars. We spend $80 billion a year on corrections. And I personally do not think that's because Americans are more criminally inclined. That's a policy choice we've made, and it's had really catastrophic effects on communities across the country.
You talked a couple of times about mandatory minimums. Is the pendulum swinging back away from them to giving judges more discretion? Are they getting more discretion, and are they using it wisely?
Right. So, great question. Yes, we are seeing on the margins a movement back from mandatory minimums. You know, and there are organizations like FAM, the Families Against Mandatory Minimums, that have been advocating for that for quite some time. So we are seeing some success on that. Your second part of the question is a really interesting one, which is that a good thing? And in my space, when I'm looking, for example, at juveniles serving life without parole, getting either resentencing hearings or parole hearings, you know, there is always the question of whether unguided discretion leads to just outcomes. Hopefully, if it's a discretionary sentencing or resentencing, an individual has an opportunity to put on a picture of their life. And in the case of a youthful offender, a picture of how they've matured and grown over their time of incarceration.
You know, I have a nephew who is now going through college admissions stuff, and he's going around and visiting various campuses. I don't think he's going to be visiting Catholic, but that's okay.
Maybe I can change his mind.
Well, one of the things that they always talk about on every one of these is we have a holistic review of the students when it comes to admissions. We look at the whole student, not just their grades. And it sounds to me like what you're advocating in the criminal justice system is a holistic review of the person sitting there who's been sentenced and or convicted.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And in fact, that's not just my idea. The United States Supreme Court in a recent trilogy of cases has held that children are different in the eyes of the law and that they must be sentenced accordingly. And in its most one of its most recent decisions, Miller versus Alabama, the court talked exactly about what you just described, that there are variables that are absolutely relevant to a child's sentencing scenario. For example, family history, access to educational and other development resources, abuse, psychological trauma, that really we should be looking, as you said, holistically. So that's certainly consistent with where the Supreme Court is urging states to go.
Speaking of abuse, what happens to these kids when they go to adult prison, particularly when they're in there for decades?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking that. I devote a whole chapter in the book to talking about the experience of coming of age in prison. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty grim reality. Children are the most vulnerable of inmates in a correctional, in an adult correctional facility because of their physical and psychological immaturity. They are most likely to be physically and sexually assaulted. And they have the highest rates of suicide among inmates because the experience is so traumatic. So, unfortunately, the conditions of confinement for youth encourage precisely the opposite of the kind of skills one needs to be successful in society.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you develop mistrust of authority and a sense of, you know, needing to be physically aggressive at all times so as to fend off attackers, those are not transferable skills to being a productive member of society. So I think we really, and I talk about this in the book, we really need to take a hard look at how we are confining kids when we have to confine them, and hopefully how we can improve them in that process. You know, we're spending, in some states, up to $150,000 a year to incarcerate youth. And so if we're going to spend that kind of money, if you think about that being the equivalent of a really incredible four-year college education, we should have something to show for it, right? We should have some improvement to that individual.
Absolutely. And if the kid is going to go in for not life, but 25 years, you go in when you're 17, 18 years old, you're going to come out when you're in your early 40s. We hope that you would be able to return to some sort of contributory role to the rest of society. But the way our prisons are run these days, with private corporations running them for profit, that's not even part of the equation, is it?
That's absolutely right. It's not part of the equation. And so there are a couple of really great points in your comment. The first is, you know, if you give a 25-year sentence to someone who's 17, that's a very different sentence than 25 years to someone who's 65.
Yep.
Right? The 17-year-old is going to come out pretty much in the prime of his life, if he can make it. So they're just different in kind, I would suggest. And the second piece that's important is that most youth who are convicted as adults will be released before their 21st birthday. In fact, it's about 80% of youth convicted as adults who will be released before their 21st birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just all the more reason that we need that experience to be one that improves and educates and rehabilitates that youthful member of society if they're going to be coming out at 21.
Paul Harris talking with Kara Drynan, Catholic University Law School professor, author of The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. Kara, you say in the book that there is a subclass of kids in the U.S. who we have deemed expendable. Who are you talking about?
Yeah, so I'm talking about, you won't be surprised to know, I'm talking about children who come from poor minority communities. And in particular, it's important to recognize that just generally in the United States, 4 out of 5 criminal defendants are poor. So 4 out of 5 criminal defendants are poor. They're entitled to representation at the state's expense under Supreme Court precedent from 1963. But that right has never really been practiced in reality. And then you have children who are coming from situations of poverty, needing and being entitled to representation that they don't, in fact, receive. And at the same time, we know that there is tremendous racial disparity in the system as well.
Yeah.
Black youth, for example, today are 5 times as likely as white youth to be incarcerated. So we just know that there's a tremendous amount of economic and racial inequality baked into the system. And it's really had a catastrophic effect on poor minority communities and their youth.
When you say the black kids are five times more likely to end up in the system, that doesn't mean they're committing five times as many crimes. In many cases, that means that Gideon has failed them because there wasn't somebody representing them in court who was good enough to make things work for them the way it would for some suburban white kid from an upper-class family.
That's exactly right. And in fact, some, you know, of the social science has looked into, well, what is driving that statistic? Is it in fact that black youth commit more crime? And we know that the studies suggest no, that's not in fact what is driving that difference in incarceration rates. There's been some really good research on the fact that, and I talk about the school to prison pipeline in the book, but there's been some good research to suggest the fact that educators and law enforcement actors most likely subconsciously, just as a matter of implicit bias, experience behaviors of black youth differently than they do the same behavior from white youth. So, for example, a 16-year-old black student in the classroom who might be sort of acting out in a class clown kind of way might not be labeled class clown. He might be labeled aggressive and disruptive, whereas the white child doing the same thing would be labeled class clown. So we know that there is, as I said, implicit bias that's driving these differential experiences.
If you would, I'd like you to tell my audience the story of one Robert Pruitt of Texas. Do you mind?
Sure. So Robert Pruitt is not a case that is highlighted in the War on Kids because his case really was postdated in my book and was a capital case, which was not the focus of my book. But Robert Pruitt was executed in Texas in October. And one of the reasons that I wrote recently in the USA Today about his case was just to highlight the way in which youth like Robert Pruitt, who come from a familial environment of substance abuse and poverty and, psychological trauma, often find themselves in the system. And historically, when he was originally convicted in the 1990s, none of that information was relevant. And so Robert Pruitt was executed despite the fact that, as I said, if he had been in the judicial system today facing the kinds of charges that he was facing at the time, he really would have had the benefit of the court under Supreme Court precedent looking into his family background and so forth.
Yep.
Pruitt's conviction was primarily based on the fact that his father had been the primary actor in a homicide crime, and Pruitt had been there and was charged essentially under an accomplice liability theory. So it was just really tragic because not only was it a situation where he was a youth at the time, but he wasn't even the primary actor in this crime. And we see that often happening in juvenile homicide cases because, again, going back to youth and maturity, juveniles can be persuaded or talked into being a participant in a crime, even if they're not a primary actor.
Particularly when it's your father who's committing the crime.
Right, absolutely. When it's your father, and when it's your father, in Pruitt's case, who was someone he had feared almost from the beginning of his life, who had been physically and verbally abusive, who'd been in and out of prison. So absolutely, there's a clear power dynamic in that situation that, as I said, today a court would have been required to take into account.
All right, here's the last thing I want to talk to you about, and it goes back to the very first thing you mentioned, which is how decades ago our legislators at every level, state and federal, decided we have to get tougher on crime in this country because we were having an increase in the crime rate. But now that number is dramatically down, and you talk about a pendulum that it can't swing backwards. You got people running for office in this country who, if they were to advocate for doing something about this problem, their opponents would charge them with being soft on crime. Does that make it unlikely that the laws are going to be changed for the better?
I do not think so. I remain optimistic about the prospect for criminal justice reform in this country, because I think, unfortunately, what we're hearing, the rhetoric that we're hearing from the White House and top justice officials, is unfortunately just that. It's rhetoric. It's not grounded in science. So, for example, despite the fact that we hear about rising crime rates, they are not rising. We're still at a historic low in terms of violent crime in this country.
Yeah.
And I actually think that most voters on the ground and many lawmakers at the federal level across the aisle on all sides of the spectrum are engaged in the facts. So I am confident in the American people, and I think if you look to a state like Virginia and their election recently, you can see that people are tuning out that rhetoric. And so I'm going to remain optimistic about the prospects for criminal justice reform.
I hope your optimism is warranted, Kara. The book is called The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. This is Kara Drynan, a juvenile justice expert and professor at Catholic University Law School in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.